Dialectical Behavior Therapy was created in the 1980s by Marsha Linehan in Seattle, Washington.
Today, DBT is taught all over the world.
We're two therapists who believe everyone can benefit from DBT skills.
I'm Kate.
I'm Michelle.
And this is DBT and Me.
Hello, everyone.
Hello, everybody.
Welcome to Q&A 70.
Yippee.
Point one. I know, right? The after take, I don't know, the second take. I don't know how. I must have fumbled with it, just bringing it out of the box or something. But guys, I managed to hit something on my recorder the last time we recorded this. Yes, I did say that. That meant I recorded nothing. I recorded the entire time of nothing. It isn't that I made no recording. My recording contained no sound.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It all looked good on paper when you sent me your audio.
It took the right time to download and everything else.
Yep. Like, and then sent it to my brother for editing, and he replied back. It was like, Kate has no audio. And we were like, oh, that wasn't supposed to happen at all.
Not at all. Not in the slightest. So we'll see. There's at least one thing I can say I have added since the last one. So it's better. Let's go. But you start us off with the second take, Michelle.
I do. Yes. I'm going to read the first one for this second take. So this listener says, I just finished 36 TMS, which stands for transcranial magnetic stimulation sessions, and now hope for the changes many people have seen in their attitude and happiness following TMS. My biggest concern is I'm afraid to be happy. I spend a lot of time waiting for the other shoe to drop if something good happens to me. Does anyone else feel this way? Do you have any good tips to power through and simply be okay with being happy?
I love this question. Mm-hmm. First of all, I hope that this listener is getting some of the changes that they were hoping to see. And also, does anyone else feel this way? Hells yes. So many people feel this way, right? Can feel that it's almost easier to be in a dark or hard or unhappy place because at least then you're not waiting for the dark and the hard and the unhappy to strike, right? And so somehow good things actually make people brace for the bad thing that feels like it's inevitably coming. So yes, you are not alone, not even in the slightest. So my just a giant heaping dose of validation to start with. But first skill that I thought of, and apparently I thought it so hard I put it in all caps in my notes, was mindfulness. But mindfulness starting small, right? So it's, first of all, Michelle and I both agree that it's pretty unlikely that you would be, I don't know, mindful for the entire time it takes to watch a football game. That's a long thing, right?
Yeah, it's like 3.5 hours.
Right? All right, so you're probably not going to be mindful, even if you're someone who's regularly mindful and awesome at it. You're probably not going to be mindful for the entirety of that big of a nice event or something like that anyway. But also, it can feel overwhelming, right? To try and take in the entirety of something or a larger event or a longer series of moments when you have had this historical fear-based relationship with happiness or with joy or with pleasure. And so my first thought is to start mindfulness, but start it super small. So for instance, something like, I am going to sit in the joy of smelling this flower for just one breath. Right? Like, that's it. I am just going to lean in to this pleasure, this joy, right? This happiness, whatever word you want to use to describe it, for this moment. And then I'm going to allow myself to sort of back out of that mindful space again, because so sort of build tolerance, right? Sort of, I don't know, has anyone ever worked to build tolerance to spicy food, right? Like that kind of thing. You're essentially building your tolerance to the mindful experience of happiness, right? So now I'm going to sit and be mindful of the experience of drinking this entire cup of tea, right? It's going to take me 10 minutes and I'm going to be here and present to it the whole time, right? So just this sort of gradual building up of your ability to recognize, enjoy, and tolerate enjoyable things before building to hold events, which again, the whole events, you're not going to be mindful the entire time, but ideally, if you've been practicing your mindfulness of the joy in these smaller events, you've built your tolerance to the experience of that emotion. So even if you're not mindfully happy for the whole 3.5 hours of the sports ball event, you can allow the happiness to be present for the entirety of the event without feeling the need to chase it away. When it comes to other DBT skills, another one I thought of was checking the facts. Basically using check the facts to be like, does my happiness make sense right now? Does my joy or my pleasure make sense right now about this thing? So essentially utilizing it as a tool of validation, I suppose you could come to the answer that your being happy is unwarranted. But by golly, by gumball, that's not the problem that I find with most people. Most people do not have inappropriate happiness, especially, right, that are struggling with depression is more the other way around, right? So more a tool of validation for your happiness of using to check the facts in that regard. And then a thing that I've probably mentioned somewhere on the podcast at some point, because it's a thing I really like to, a way I like to think about things, but boy, howdy, do I not know when and where. So a thing that I like to tell my clients to do is decide how they would rather fuck up. If you are going into a pleasurable experience, a happy moment in your world, and we assume you can either choose to be braced, right, and kind of ready for the other shoe to drop, right, and so not engaged in the happiness, right, in that sort of guarded, disengaged, perhaps, sort of way. And let's, that could be a fuck up. And it turns out that no shoe ever drops. It never dropped. We just went through the whole of the event. Everything went fine. It came to its natural conclusion. There was no need to be braced, right, for that event. That's one way you could fuck up with approaching happy events. Another way you could fuck up with approaching happy events is be like, I'm sure this is going to be fine, and just throw ourselves wholesale into the happiness of it. And then, potentially, something does go wrong. A shoe does drop. Something goes catastrophically awry. Thinking about a birthday party I went to where the birthday girl ended up quite accidentally getting pushed through a glass door and having to go to the hospital in an ambulance. That was not great. Now do I want to go to every birthday party I ever go to from that point on? Like, oh God, when is the medical emergency going to happen? Right? Because that's one way I could fuck up. Or I could be like, nothing bad is ever again going to happen at a party. That was my one lightning strike. And then be, oh shit, something bad actually happened. Right? I'm not saying it's guaranteed to be wrong either way. I'm just saying we can't prognosticate. We don't know what the future is going to hold. We have no fucking idea if that shoe is going to drop or not. So, since we can't know, since it's likely in either, not likely in either case, since there are possibilities in either direction being the fuck up, what kind of fuck up do you want to make? Do you want to, other illustrations might look like, do you want to fuck up by trusting too much or trusting too little? You can't know which one is going to be a mistake, so just assume that any way you could behave, they're all mistakes. Great. Now which mistake is in alignment with your values, in alignment with the kind of person you're trying to be, what's more in alignment with your morals, right? And because then, if it does turn out that it was in fact a fuck-up, you're going to be able to weather that fuck-up with a lot more emotional resilience than if you fucked up in a way that also feels outside of your morals or your values or your standards of behavior. For me, for instance, I would say in the trust one, I would rather choose to fuck up by trusting too much and getting burned. That's what I would rather do. So if I found myself in a situation where instead I was overly guarded and lost an opportunity at a friendship because I was unwilling to trust somebody, that would feel really gross to me because that's not me. So both it would be a fuck up and it would be something that felt out of alignment with myself. So since we can't know how things are going to go for any duration in time. I don't even know how this podcast is going to go. See the aforementioned, it didn't fucking record. Anyway, right? Right? So, like, am I going to freak out every single time I record now? No, I can't. That's not sustainable for me. I'd rather fuck up by being surprised again someday to find out that we didn't make any audio. But that's me. I think sometimes I accidentally... Well, I'm sure I accidentally sound sometimes like one is the right answer. It's because I'm biased. We're all biased towards the ways we'd rather fuck up. But that doesn't mean that's the way anybody listening to this would rather fuck up. But it's good to have awareness of it and why you'd rather fuck up that way, right? So have that self-inquiry, right? Get curious and be like, huh, if I assume that every way I could possibly behave here is a mistake, which mistake am I most comfortable with making? And I think that this listener, go read the book. There you go. Weird insert promo. This listener could get something out of that concept, I think. So those are my thoughts, Michelle. How about you?
Yeah, maybe building on some of what you were saying there towards the end of your sharing is that, yes, I mean, the other shoe is going to drop. And a lot of times when we are waiting for the other shoe to drop, it's us getting in our head trying to predict what that shoe is going to be and when it's going to happen. And yes, it's impossible for us to know. That's stuff that most of the time we cannot predetermine of what, you know, the specific quote unquote shoe will be and when it will come to us. But what we can say with pretty much certainty is that there will inevitably be stressors in life until the day we die. So I don't know if that's a helpful way to look at it, but I think sometimes we spend so much time fearing, you know, yeah, like, is this going to happen? Is this going to happen? Is it going to happen? And to just be like, yeah, it is going to happen. Like, probably at some point, something really hard and bad is going to happen in my life. So then that, like, takes the fear out of it maybe a little bit to just, you know, accept that it's going to. And it is. It's a hard place to be with the uncertainty of not knowing what it's going to look like. That's really difficult. That's why I like your thing about the, you know, like, is that where you want to live? Right? Is that how you want to fuck up? Is by, you know, spending a lot of time in your brain thinking about what it's going to look like? Or would you rather fuck up by not thinking about it and then being blindsided when it happens? You know, just pick your poison. One thing that stood out to me, though, in what this listener wrote is the use of the word happy. You know, that is the most generic word we assign to the emotion of joy. But we recorded an episode, if you haven't listened to it already, listener, it came out on July 30th, 2024. So actually, almost a year ago now. Yeah, crazy. I think it was one of our first ones back from me being on maternity leave, which is wild. And my daughter's a year old now, so it's crazy. But the title of that episode is DBT and Finding Joy. So we really address some of these concerns, which is that when it feels like it's really hard to find joy, what are some ways to find it? Kate already gave a spectacular tip of just starting really, really, really small with mindfulness. And the other thing that was a little more subtle in that episode, but I want to repeat it here, which is that there can be a lot of other words for joy besides happiness, being happy. When I hear the word happy, it feels very, I guess, like externally based, like something good is happening. So I feel happy and I will probably feel happy until this thing ends. And then hopefully something else great will happen and then I'll feel happy again as something else good happens externally. But there's a lot of other words that I wonder if some of these may resonate more for you, listener, which are words like peace, feeling content, like being in a state of flow. Like, you know, with any emotion, there's a spectrum. You know, I'm probably the extreme end of joy would be, I don't know, ecstasy, right? But maybe start with trying to feel some more mild joy, which would probably be like, I feel calm. And like Kate was saying, you can work up to the experience of like happiness, whatever that may mean to you. Skills-wise, I was already touching on a little bit, but I'll explicitly name it, which is radical acceptance. Radical acceptance of, gosh, the fact that there are the stressful, hard things in life. Accepting those when they come, knowing that they will. And also accepting the moments of joy, however you're experiencing it. But it's also probably not going to be that you may exclusively only feel joy at any given moment. You can feel a whole lot of emotions all at once. And so making space for all of your emotions, accepting all of them, and making sure that you're not shitting on yourself of like, this should make me feel happy. No, except if you don't feel happy during something. Okay, I'm not feeling happy right now. I'm not in the experience of joy. That's okay. Accept whatever emotion you are feeling. And again, if joy does come along, accept that too. So just really taking this like non-judgmental, open-minded, radical acceptance approach to all of your emotions rather than judging some as better than others and saying like, this is what I'm supposed to feel. I'm supposed to feel happy. Not necessarily. So hopefully that may help a little bit.
I like that a lot. Also, if I squawk in the middle of a sentence, Jin is in my lap and he has very sharp claws and he is trying to say he loves me with his razors.
By kneading you.
Yes, exactly. Yes, by making muffins on my flesh. So anyway, sometimes I can't catch him and I squeak. So let's see. Next one reads, how can I differentiate between cope ahead and safety behaviors? I've been thinking about this a lot lately. For a long time, I've struggled with social anxiety. It has gotten a lot better, but on some days it still impacts my life. Now to my question. Over the past few weeks, I have done a lot of research on anxiety and safety behaviors. My main finding has been that in order to get over the anxiety, you have to let go of safety behaviors. I thought that packing fidgets, water bottles, everything I might need, and thinking about what skills might be useful in difficult situations was a form of self-care and cope ahead, but is it possible I've just been enabling myself the entire time? Having a backup plan and coping skills helps me to feel less anxious about going into new situations, but I don't want this to stop me from getting over my anxiety. Am I missing something here? Maybe I just misunderstood the purpose of cope ahead. I'd be really grateful for any input and or advice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. While cope ahead can be a really great skill for anxiety, I don't know. It's called cope ahead for a reason. It is not the skill when you are already in anxiety. That is not the skill that you need in that moment. The skill that you probably need is more opposite action, which this listener said nothing about, but I'm going to weave it in a little bit to talking about their questions. Because opposite action, right? Anxiety is fear. Fear often tells us to avoid the thing that is making us feel afraid, even if it's not something that can actually harm us. And when we face that thing that we are feeling afraid of and we see that, oh, that wasn't so bad. Oh, I'm okay. I made it to the other side of that. I did it. I survived. Then that tells your brain, maybe this thing is not as scary as I thought it was. So then the next time you do encounter a situation like that, you might feel less afraid. And opposite action helps you get there. However, to do opposite action, you probably need to like call in the troops a little bit. If you're going to be approaching something that really freaks you out and overwhelms you, it can lead to panic attacks and all of that. Yeah, I want you to have things on hand just in case it gets real hard. Because opposite action can get real hard, especially if you're doing, as DBT puts it, all the way opposite action. Yeah. Brace yourself, because you're going to have moments where you want to stop and you don't want to go any further. And your brain's going to be, you know, going back to all its normal ways of thinking. And if you have something, you know, this listener was talking about like quite a few like physical objects that they find helpful. But if you have something that you can go to and use, or a person you can call, or whatever it is in those moments that are going to help you complete opposite action and get to the other side of the anxious situation, use those things. So it's kind of interesting because, right, the whole, you know, I thought that using these things might be useful in difficult situations as a form of self-care and cope ahead, but is it just enabling me? Like, I very much view it as that's hopefully helping you just get to the other side, right? If we go on a boat, you might be wearing a life vest. Like, that's there in case shit goes down, that you're not going to drown if an emergency happens. Same thing. The examples this listener lists are the equivalent of like a life jacket for them when they're going to be doing something that's really tough. Something that can be considered is that over time, you may find that you don't need those things as much. You know, you may find, oh yeah, I've been using, I don't know, let's say you're starting a new job and you feel really anxious about it. And you find that when you've been sitting at your desk lately, it's really helped to have your fidget. Great. Yeah. Like use your fidget as for as long and as much as you need to. But you may find that there's one day where you're like, I didn't use my fidget very much today. Okay. Doesn't mean to like necessarily like, you know, well, no more fidget, gonna get rid of it. You might still want it on hand, but that is a thing that you may become aware of, is that you don't need those things as much over time, and, or you may need very different things than you needed at the beginning, and that's all very normal. If you want to try to intentionally decrease or change what you're using as coping skills, you can, but you also don't have to. You know, if you put together like, you know, we call it like a self-soothing kit, right? Or, you know, some kind of like crisis survival. I need these things on hand in case anxiety really strikes me. You may keep those things on you for a very long time, even if you go months without using them. And I don't think that's anything to be ashamed of. And I don't think that's anything problematic. So I hope that clarifies my perspective on what this listener is saying. What about you, Kate?
I definitely have thoughts. I also have, there we go, a goose in the room. So if there's noises in the background, I'm sorry, folks.
All the animals, all the pets.
All the animals. I feel like Dr. Doolittle. All right. But it really is interesting, Michelle, because I like it. You're like, oh, I think not quite what you're looking for, but this is what I think would help you really, and sort of a description of what you're doing, where my brain for this question went more about like, oh, let's talk about what cope ahead really is and how you could use it here. So I like that our brains went different places a little bit.
That's a good pairing.
Right, because it's true. I don't think that what the listener described might not quite be classic cope ahead and more about like mindful planning. And then as you were nicely touching on, once, you know, they're actually in the situation, hopefully that mindful planning has given them the life vest, to steal your metaphor, to make it, you know, through that anxiety producing situation. Right. So mindful planning, not quite the same thing as cope ahead. That being said, I also don't personally think that anything that the I say personally, I guess what I really mean is professionally, right? I don't think immediately that any of those sound like anxiety enabling behaviors, right? Though obviously I don't know this listener technically, so grains of salt and everything there. But there are definitely more problematic behaviors that I've heard people describe in attempts to maintain, you know, to manage their anxiety. This sounds more like I might get anxious. How are some good ways that I could, you know, make it through that experience if it arises? Which is great. Especially because that allows you to then do the thing that makes you anxious. And that's really the way that you fight anxiety, as Michelle was talking about, right? It's the whole opposite action thing. So how could you, though, use cope ahead? And then the situation that this listener described, what cope ahead I think might look like is after they perhaps sat and thought about what skills might be helpful, like they listed doing, they could spend 10 minutes visualizing themselves using that skill in the upcoming situation. So to just keep my brain is not giving me the right word, piggybacking. It kept saying pickpocketing. I'm like, not what I want at all. To keep piggybacking on what you were saying, Michelle, if the person was like, I'm going to be practicing opposite action in this upcoming situation, then they could sit and imagine themselves utilizing opposite action, imagining what it would feel like, what which of those things that they've, you know, packed would they reach for in that moment? What other skills could they use too? Right. And walking themselves in their imagination through the actual experience as though they were using the skill in that experience. Great way to use cope ahead and make yourself even more likely to reach for the skills that you want to when the situation arises. So yeah, simply picking skills that are good to have on deck for a situation wouldn't quite count as using cope ahead, but I do think it would count as healthy preparation, and you could certainly fold it into a cope ahead type of practice as well if you wanted to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, the next one is really short, but
so short.
It's a big question. It says, is there a DBT skill I could use when I think I'm being gaslighted or suspected?
Yeah. You're right, it's a big one. Because my brain goes to DBT skills almost instantly, the first thing I thought about, again, actually was checking the facts, but using it as a means of validation, right? Like, what do I actually know? What am I responding to here? You know, so working your way through the situation and the questions that it asks. Honestly, I would, this is one of the few places, not few, that's giving it short shrift. There are plenty of places where I would rather do the shorter version of checking the facts and would encourage others to do so also. But I think this is one of the places where doing the whole worksheet actually could be really beneficial for someone who's really wanting to see that they're really grounded in reality, right? And they can sort of spell it out for themselves through the worksheet. So I think utilizing check the facts for validation could really work. The next suggestion depends a lot on whether or not after checking the facts, the person comes to the conclusion that they are or are not being gaslit. And also, this might be controversial, I don't know. But I do believe people can engage in behaviors that somewhere between are or at the very least look damn near identical to gaslighting behaviors, but without the intention. Like they're defensive in some fashion, right? Like they're not saying that they're healthy or excusable, but they're not a systematic attempt to undermine the person's sense of reality. They are a coping mechanism in the other person's psyche. So if you have reason to believe that the person is not intending this harm, you might use Dear Man to ask the person to stop those behaviors, right? To bring awareness to what they're doing, how it impacts you, and ask for a stop to that specific behavior. If this is someone who you come to the conclusion really is genuinely gaslighting you in the most a literal definition of being gaslit, which does, I think, necessitate that intention, then I would not necessarily bother with doing a Dear Man. So that's a sort of if-then recommendation, not under all circumstances. Absolutely a big plug for mindfulness of yourself, of your body, of the other person, of your emotions, of damn near anything, right? Like to, again, stay grounded, stay in the moment, stick to reality, right? Mindfulness requires us to be in that non-judgmental space and also to be as objective as possible. And both of those things are really great for combating the kind of self-doubt and storytelling that can come with gaslighting or gaslighting-like behaviors. And I know, different from the Dear Man is if you really need to like, nah, this has to stop, or I can't do this anymore, or I'm not engaging this relationship anymore, or whatever the thing is, if there's a real hard line boundary that needs to be set, I did think that the person could potentially use FAST instead of Dear Man to be like, nope, this shit has to stop. But yep, those were the DBT skills that I would lean on, or checking the facts, Dear Man maybe, tons of mindfulness, and FAST as needed. What about you, Michelle?
Yeah. I'm going to add on a few more. So this listener has a lot to choose from because, you know, we say this often, but this might be a situation that bears repeating of like, it's okay to just pick one and start there.
Yeah.
don't want people to experience skills overload where they're like, hey, Michelle recommended that I do like 7 things. I've got to do them all. You definitely don't. Pick what feels like it's going to be a fit for you and pick one to start with. And then once you see the outcome of using that skill, then you can add on more. So this is meant to be a menu that you pick from, listener. One skill, though, that we did have overlap on was check the facts. And I agree with you, Kate. I think this could be a situation where it would be really good to take the time to actually go through a check the facts worksheet, because one of the great things about check the facts that happens very early on in the process is that you are asked to, you know, think about the series of events that happened as objectively as possible. And that can be very helpful when you're dealing with a potential gaslighting situation where the person may be telling you that things happened or that you said things or that you felt things that, you know, somewhere inside of you, you're like, I really don't think I said that, or I didn't feel that way at that time, but they're saying that, you know, I did, or that kind of a thing. Check the facts can be a tool in your toolbox to help really start with getting clear on what actually happened, assuming that the other person is trying to tell you the events went differently than they actually did. Another way that you can use check the facts, I'm going a little off book here with it, but having a trusted other that you can talk to. Having somebody else in your life, especially if they are witnessing the dynamic between you and the person who is, you know, the potential gaslighter. If other people were there for an event that happened and, you know, you're recalling it one way and then the other person, you know, the quote unquote, you know, potential gaslighter is saying, no, it didn't happen that way, or, you know, this is what you did. This is how you harmed me. And you're like, I really, you know, was not trying to harm you, or whatever it looks like. Having another person that you can go to be like, look, how do you recall things happening? What's your take on events? Or what do you feel really confident saying? Again, pretty objectively that you've seen in this relationship dynamic between me and this other person over time. What are some things that you've observed about their behavior or about us together or that kind of a thing? Just having somebody to talk about it with can really help to just kind of like, I don't know, fact check a little bit, especially if you're struggling with checking the facts yourself. Yeah. But to introduce a skill that has not been shared yet, my brain really went to the importance of wise mind. Cultivating your wise mind, trusting your wise mind in this situation with this potential gaslighting going on, this may feel like expert level to use your wise mind. But if you can find other areas or places in your life where you can really start finding that spot for yourself of where you're making decisions from an empowered place, you're feeling pretty confident, where you are really able to, you know, like we talk about with Wise Mind. And we did also, I didn't put the date in here, but we did also recently release a updated Wise Mind episode where we just talked about Wise Mind recently, but where you really feel like you can access both what your emotions are wanting to share with you and also really access, you know, this logical, analytical part of you and feel into both areas. And really doing that when you notice little alarm bells going off inside of you that are like, hold on a second. What this person is saying really is not fitting for me. Yes, it could just be a difference of opinions. It could just be a difference in remembering events. Our memories, you know, make mistakes all the time. However, it could be something deeper going on where it really, there really is some underlying manipulation that could be there. And I really think that if you can lean into your wise mind, that will help you discern what's going on in this situation and maybe give you some clarity on what you do next or how to respond to this person, especially if it's somebody that's maybe gonna be in your life for a little bit. Wise mind is gonna be your friend. So if you don't feel like you have a good connection with your wise mind right now, that can take time to build. But listen to our Revisiting Wise Mind episode and, you know, see if you can start really getting in touch with it. And then the last thing I'll share, which interestingly enough, I talked about in our last monthly episode as one of my skills that I struggle with, but I'm recommending it here to you, listener, is it may oddly be helpful to do a behavior chain analysis. Now, a little bit outside the box here, to be fair, because BCAs, as I name in that episode, right, they're meant to be for problem behaviors. You wouldn't be using it for that purpose. So it always feels odd when I'm like, hey, use this skill, but I'm actually really recommending it. You use it in a way that it's totally not recommended for, but it could be helpful for you. But the specific piece of the BCA that I think might be helpful, even though it's time consuming, is the chain part of the behavior chain analysis. Really walking through step by step. Again, kind of the intention of this might be to check the facts a little bit, but like to really make sure that you are able to spell out as best you can recall what happened moment by moment, externally, internally, how things unfolded in a situation after it's finished, and if it feels like there's gaslighting going on around it. Really do that on your own to get in touch with what was I experiencing? Because the BCA asks you to put in chains, we could say, about your emotions, about your physical body sensations, about your thoughts. Like really looking at what was happening internally for me this entire time. Because guess what? Nobody is an expert on what's going on internally for you except you. Nobody else. So if they want to try to say, yeah, you were feeling this way, how do they know? You know that. You know your emotions. So a BCA may also be a good way to just help you get some clarity on events if it feels like there's gaslighting going on around it. All right, last one.
Yes, last one. And I like the BCA for that one, actually, even though it's off book a little bit. So this one reads, I am so thankful that I am able to emotionally regulate a lot more often than I used to be able to and not go into rage like I used to. I'm in a DBT group currently. And, dialectics, I still feel really strong sadness and pain. I'd love to know how to work through my intense sadness, probably some inner child stuff. Currently, I want my coach to quote-unquote adopt me, and I get very sensitive slash insulted with any boundary she sets, and I cry after seeing her. She's my current obsession, too, unfortunately.
Really feels like there's two parts, in a way, to what this listener wrote in. There's this first part of I'm working on emotionally regulating, and I see a lot of change that's happened for me. However, sadness is a tough one. There's that part. And then there's also the second part about how they feel towards their coach. And I really want to address both a little bit in my response. So I'll start with the sadness piece. My favorite DBT skill for sadness is improve. I think improve has some wonderful things in there that, I don't know, it just strikes me as a more like softer DBT skill. You know, we love self-soothing for the same reason, but probably no surprise to all of you, Kate's going to recommend that. So I'm not going to say anything further. But yes, just because we get better at emotional regulation doesn't mean that we stop feeling feelings. Doesn't mean that. It just means that we turn to more effective ways to express our emotions. You know, more skillful ways, we could say, than perhaps before. So improve can be a nice way, I think, to just give your sadness some love. You can pick any of the things from the acronym that fit for you. And the other thing that feels important to say about really intense emotions and DBT skills, because as this listener said, they were like, you know, yeah, probably need to do, it's probably from some inner child stuff. Like, yeah, DBT skills can be really, really helpful. And also, they're not going to drop emotional intensity most of the time from, like, if you're feeling sadness out of 10 and you use a DBT skill, it's probably not going to just, like, magically make the sadness go away and bring it down to a 1. And that's not actually the point. The point is not to make you stop feeling sadness and pain. The point is to see if we can lower it, say, by like 1 to 2 points on that 1 through 10 scale. You're feeling it at 10 and then you use a DBT scale and now you feel it at an 8, spectacular. Because probably when you're in what I call maybe like the sweet spot, which is like 4 to 7 on that 1 to 10 range, that means your emotion is manageable. You're feeling it, but it's not overwhelming you and consuming you. You can be with it, right? For anything less than a 4, maybe we're having a hard time actually considering our emotions. Though sometimes things do just feel milder. And yeah, if we're an 8 or above, we're probably just way in emotion mind. And that's not a place that we want to make decisions from with what we do next. So yeah, if you can use a skill and it might shift the experience of the sadness slightly, that's great. But no, the goal is not to make it go away. Hate to disappoint if that's what you're deep down hoping for. The second piece about the stuff with the coach, my biggest question is, have you shared this with your coach? I sincerely hope your answer is yes, but I don't know if it is. I have no way to know. If you haven't, I would encourage you to. I know that may feel very scary to do, and also, therapy is a great space to find healing from childhood stuff, which you said you suspect that's what's underlying some of this stuff with your coach, which, I mean, tracks from just what little I know. So when we bring those things to the therapy relationship and say, hey, this is how I'm feeling towards you, right? Therapist, coach, whatever the person's role is, that is a space where you can actually be like held in what you're experiencing. Yes, we are humans too, but we're trained in how to be with the potentially unhealthy attachment stuff. We are trained to be with the big feelings. This is what we do day in and day out. And we do it in a way that's, you know, loving and appropriate and safe. Now, if your coach doesn't take that approach, because I don't know who your coach is, yeah, that will really disappoint me. But I think it might be good to share these feelings with her. And I just also want to give, I don't think I put this in my notes, but like kudos for you, listener, for being so transparent and open about sharing that piece. I would hazard to guess that you probably feel a bit of shame for how you're feeling about wanting your coach to adopt you, and look at you just like naming it and saying, this is something that is maybe hard for me to talk about, but I'm going to be honest and authentic about it, even if it is just being open in the space of our Facebook group. Like, truly, that's a big thing to do and something for you to feel proud of, that you were open to naming that that's how you're feeling towards her. And now it might just be taking that step towards naming it to her and letting her in on how you're feeling. All right, your turn, Kate.
All right, so let's see. The first thing I have in here is that I love DBT, but, which is not the great start, but it's true, right? I love DBT for skills for handling in the moment stresses and distresses and behaviors, etc. And I would say that it's not necessarily the best tool in someone's toolbox for helping with deep underlying issues, like it sounds like this listener was describing, around like their inner child work and things like that. You sort of were alluding to that, like, bring it up with your therapist. Therapy is a great place to talk about it. And I think that one of the reasons is that many therapists, at least, it's not just DBT skills. If I were this listener or their or working with them, I might have them leaning towards things more like mindful self-compassion in the situation that they listed. I too can speak. At least as I understood it. And I think a lot of that was my orientation towards their experience with those, the inner child stuff or their experience with their therapist. For DBT specific skills, I would say, as you said, self-soothing, right? This could be for before or after sessions with the therapist if those are really distressing, and just as a way to meet that deep sadness, right? With a way that maybe it or you weren't tenderly held in your childhood. Can you perhaps tenderly hold yourself and that sadness in a way that you weren't given if you have those deep childhood wounds? That being said, if the sadness is intense, as in I'm crying so hard I'm vomiting, you might want to practice self-soothing after some tip or something else to help bring yourself down to a more manageable level, similarly to what Michelle was talking about being in that sweet spot. I do think checking the facts can help. If it turns out that your deep sadness isn't about some deep childhood shit, but is instead just a reaction that your brain is having to an in-the-moment thing where you're like, oh, shit, okay, I can see where this is rooted, but it's not necessarily a deep childhood wound so much as just habitual patterns of thought or behavior. Check the facts can help point you to that and towards, as we were saying with a couple of responses ago, to opposite action if it turns out that that's what that sadness actually needs. Riding the wave along with tip, if the intensity is more at that end of I'm crying so hard I'm vomiting, as opposed to a more melancholy or quiet sadness. And when it comes to, again, potentially looking at things with the therapist, I would say that effective rethinking and paired relaxation might help as a way to prep for some of their sessions together. And then last, but certainly not least, one of the things I was thinking about, just that one line, and I'm reading a lot into it, right? So listener, if you're like, get to this episode and you're like, this is so fucking off, then pardon me, I was reading a lot into the line, she's my current obsession too, because that can mean a lot of different things. But potentially, we have an episode that was released on April 30th of 2025 on this idea of limerence that I think this listener might potentially... it might really resonate with them, in which case we have a whole episode of other things to say that could be helpful and useful to that person. So, yeah.
I think okay. That's it for me. We did it. Let's hope the audio works this time. Sweet, so we don't have to do this a third go around.
I sincerely, sincerely desire that outcome.
Right? Okay, so if you have questions for us, there's two ways to get those our way. Option number one is that you can email them to us at dbtandmepodcast@gmail.com, or you can post them in our Facebook group. So if you haven't joined our Facebook group yet, just search for DBT and Me Podcast when you're logged into Facebook, and that can be a great place to post your questions and get lots of different perspectives from other people who are very wise members of our Facebook group. We have incredible people in our Facebook group. So those are ways you can get questions to us, and we will see you all soon, hopefully, for our next Q&A.
Excellent. See you guys soon.
All right. Thanks, everybody. To learn more about us and the DBT skills we're teaching each week, join our Facebook group. Simply log in to your Facebook profile and search for DBT and Me Podcast.